Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Here we are, the gathering, and the gathering is gathering momentum, and gathering people, and gathering energy. And I don't feel a flagging of energy. I think certainly I feel a gathering of enthusiasm and meaning as to what the occasion is about. Yeah. Beautiful presentation of celebration, acknowledgement, gratitude, and harmony. And that's exactly where the Lumpur Samedo wanted to have Amrawadi, as for an occasion such as this, when Sangha can get together. And, you know, very important. So we kind of come out of our separate locations, our separate ways of doing things, you know, little idiosyncrasies just merge, and a really cleansing process and harmony process. So it's certainly lovely to see so many people coming from all over the world. You know, it gives us a sense of just how wide and deep and diverse this dispensation can be without losing coherence. It still remains integrated, whole, unbroken. So a big namo dana to the Amrawadi community, Ajahn Amro and Ajahn Nyanarato, but of course the whole community, for putting it on, for being willing to undertake it and doing it. You know, I've looked around and see just even the men's side of things. There's a lot of little tents and people six in a room, and you know, people live on blankets in various corners. Every time you open a cupboard, there's somebody living inside it. And I also get good warm humor, and people really enjoying themselves the way I see it. So actually, it's marvelous, really. And clearly all the sisters have contributed, and everybody's contributed. I don't feel a sense of strain or anxiety, you know, getting it all right. So that's beautiful, that there's plenty of open space also, so it's not too rushing from one thing to the next. And it's letting nature take its course when you've got this amount of seasoned summonerhood around, then, you know, it's not going to go far off. It doesn't need a lot of detailed steering. And that's also a beautiful sign. You know, people have got their own sense of presence and integrity and respect and good, and what the occasion is about. Then it's self-monitoring, and everybody contributes their own axis, their own balance, their own good humor, their own willingness to serve the greater whole. And that's there it is, you know. How often does that happen in the world? You know. I mean, just looking at the flower arrangement on the shrine. I don't know who did that, but my goodness. You know, and listening to some of the core qualities that have been presented in that, you know, a certain amount of sacrifice. And that's really very pivotal to the whole of what we're doing. As noted, Sijastaji Virudhama lightly touched on it the other day, you know, when he said basically how he got here was when he was going, he was in Thailand for a few years and just settling into life at Wat Pa Phong and you know, Nana Chat and so forth, and then go home, visit parents for a few weeks, then go back to Thailand, actually visit parents, then get a message, don't go back to Thailand, go to live in London instead. You know, damp, grey tenement house in London when you've been out in the forest of northeast Thailand, southern. Okay. Okay. You know, and I think when you look along, review the line of elders, the ones I know, it's pretty much the same story. The surrender. You know, that's what we called it in those days, the surrender. And Nampo Sameda himself, exactly the same, really modelled it. You know, surrender, Nampo Cha, didn't really want to go to England, Nampo Cha, okay, you go there, okay. Don't know how to do it, don't know what it's like, never been to England before, don't know the culture, don't know the people, but okay. You know, and just that as a practice, and the kind of what that brings to light, you know, what that triggers, you know, both obviously some sense of willingness and wish, but also enormous challenges in terms of one's psychology, in terms of one's confidence, feeling bereft, feeling alone, feeling, you know, insecure, and it's just holding it as a practice. You hear the anecdotes, and they're pretty much along that line. You know, Lumpur Sumedha, when he spent his vasa up in, I've forgotten the name of the place, this little hill, what was it called? And Sakondakorn, Phupiek, wasn't it? Phupiek Mountain, yeah. We practically living under this, got sick, and his foot flared up, and he had fever, and he's stuck up in his tin-roofed hut on your own, blazing heat, just feeling totally bereft, and then just basically just pulling it together, see, you know, hold it together, and came out kind of both ragged and torn and physically stressed, but somehow more and more stronger through the meeting, the challenge. You know, and that was pretty, I mean, they're not all physical challenges, you know. When Ajahn Amaro came here, obviously he'd been in Britain before, then he'd gone to Abhayagiri, the invitation, just give this up, go to Abhayagiri, start that place, get settled in there, and then, oh, please come back, give up the monastery you've just established, 15 years of it, okay. You know, so that sense of just, you know, everything every time is that sense of what is it doing, really? The grasping, the selfhood, the sense of permanent security, the right, fair, just, so all this, what should and shouldn't be. Okay. You know, and why? And you look at the results, so I think the why is not so easy to explain immediately, but you look at the results, you see people are both very firm, resolute, and they laugh. Firm, resolute, they're not tight. Yeah. Resolute and craggy and worn, but they laugh a lot. You know, hey, some armoring has been taken away, and instead there's a tremendous capacity to be free and loose and open without losing fundamental principles. You know, and this kind of, everyone has to meet this, really. I mean, we don't always have to have physical challenges, but everyone has meets that sense of being taken to our edge of, this isn't right, I can't manage this, I planned that, I don't know what to do about that. Okay, there you are, you're in the zone. And you could go into spinning and complaining and lashing out and getting freaking out, or you just gotta just hold it together, breathing in, breathing out, until the grasping and the fluttering and the mind is able to release. And that's kind of basic forest Dhamma practice. Whether you're in the jungle or you're in the city, that's forest Dhamma. In some ways it's not particularly refined, in some ways it's just very refined, because what happens is it brings to light the place, the pieces that we all, that I have to work with, the little pieces where I start to get a bit twitchy and, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of both very open, and yet it also brings up our triggering points, our flash points, our places of holding on, our places of security, our places of identity, you know, and how that shifts and changes. I mean, you come to this situation like this. I think when last they came to Amrawadi, okay, you know, there I am visiting Ajahn Sucitto, and then on the top of the line. Every day I get further and further down the line. As more and more elders come in, suddenly I'll be doing the dishes next, cleaning out spittoons, which is fine. I don't mind doing that either. But, you know, that's the way it goes. You know, when you kind of, when you want to be somebody, be nobody. When you want to be nobody, be somebody. When you want to just disappear and be left out, and then, oh, please, Najan, come and do the thing. Then when you want to hold on to something, oh, just disappear, you know. And when we want to... So it just really works your identity patterns, the sense in which you want to vibhava, just disappear, and bhava, you know, you want to become something permanent, and allowing the flexions and flows. And that's the kind of... This is the course. In a place like Amrawadi, for example, a group of people who really quite value living quietly on their own, build a place where hundreds of people will come and visit them. You know, But that it works it, doesn't it? You know, you want to be on your own, it's time to be with people, you want to be with people, it's time to be on your own. And then just being, but you can't even determine when that's going to happen. You follow the group harmony. And that's an extraordinary template to sense and measure, get a feeling for. And that is, in a way, the definition of Sangha, those who can live in harmony. If you're not that, you're not really, you're a recluse, but you're not a member of Sangha, really. Sonam Paul Samedo, for me, always immense mentor. I think everybody who means well deserves a miracle sometime or another. Sonam Paul Samedo was my miracle. You know, because it's both unexpected, didn't know where that was coming from, just happened to stumble in on an odd moment, find this person who for some mysterious reason had been asked to give a talk and nobody turned up apart from me. So I got a private interview with Ajahn Sumedho for 3 hours out of nowhere. I didn't particularly want to go. He turned up to do something else. And something switched, and there it was, just sitting there, you know. And then this person has got a lot of space in him. There's a lot of presence, a lot of warmth, and you can engage. And he wasn't laying down some line. You'd actually listen and take things in, and you could, you know. This is, I can't place this. Because he's not like, okay, this is your thing, you've got to do this. Wasn't laying down some technique about what I should or shouldn't be or should or shouldn't do. It's just, how are you doing? yes, well, you know, I'm just kind of interested and interesting where I was at, what I was struggling with, and, you know, that's offering the space. And so that stayed with me, because he wasn't teaching in the conventional way, and his non-teaching was a teaching. Because it wasn't like, you know, bringing out the merchandise to sell something or present something. It's just being himself was the teaching. You know? And his person, wherever he was, enormous sense of presence. Though I didn't even have that word in my vocabulary, in my lexicon, but he was really just there. And he wasn't regretting something or worrying about something next or planning something, and his body was totally steady and still but not rigid. He was comfortable, he wasn't twitching or fidgeting around, he just sitting there in this kind of sense of ground presence. But nothing hard about it. You know. And there's room. You could move into it. What's that? You know? So, as things happened, when I had to go back to Britain because of my father's decease, I thought I'd better go and see this, because I was losing it badly. I didn't have any real experience of being among outside of sitting in a meditation centre, quiet, left on my own, doing a very high degree of micro-scrutiny of sensations and so forth. I didn't have much experience of how to manage, you know, moving around in the world. I was really so ungrounded and unaware. It's like raw. And there's this crazy world flooding in. And the sanya of Britain and family and all the stuff going on, I was just almost overwhelmed. I thought, I'd better go in and see Sumedho quick. I knew he was in London, so I got somehow jumped a train or something, got down to London and rolled up at the door, banged on the door, and door opened, there's this big man saying, "Hello, I recognise you, come in." You know, and then was this presentation. There was himself and Ajahn Viradamo and Nando, and Jamajira, who was then in Agarika, and a few others. And they were just kind of something about they lived together. You know? Where I'd been before, we weren't allowed to talk to each other. We lived in little huts, we weren't allowed to talk to each other because we had to meditate. But they talked to each other. And generally in kind of good humored ways. And they had to get the meal together. And then they kind of looked, and they all sort of did something, like they'd take his bowl, Ajahn Sumedho's bowl, and they'd look after him. I was looking at all this culture presentation. Yeah. And I don't know what this is, but this is kind of like, this is a life. And it's got these seeds in it. Where there's obviously relationship. They're just eating one meal out of the bowl. There's renunciation, there's relationship, there's good humour. And clearly, you know, they're all giving up to the situation. And as I got more into it, you know, into just being there and began to fathom and understand a few things. That sense of presence, which always very strong in Ajahn Sumedho, because he did a lot, really physical. He did a good amount of physical exercise and quite strenuous. Not just as a keep fit, but as a kind of routine to get the energy of the thinking mind, to the citta, the heart's not just listening to the chattering thoughts, which could go very strange when you're in a high pressure situation, people throwing their ideas and this, that, because there's a good amount of chaos and struggle and conflict in the lay group, which way the monastery was going, if there's going to be a monastery, da-da-da-da-da, and just listen to all this. Well, something is going, I want to be back in Thailand. Get me out. You know, and then actually listening instead, the heart listening to the body. Just the energy in the body, getting into the body, doing yoga, stretching, exercising, just bringing it back into the body, bringing it into the here and now. This basic mindfulness of body, which is fundamentally, the body is always present. It has no future, no past. It's always present. Yeah. And it doesn't plan. And it doesn't have choices. It's what it is. And it's coming back to that. Again and again. And I can see that's one of the things that enabled the primary strength that's needed for meeting those challenges. Meeting challenges of a chaotic community, meeting the challenges of people arguing, and meeting the challenges of uncertainty, meeting the challenges of feeling alone, isolated, what am I doing here? Yeah. Why did I get sent here? It's not fair, kind of thing. Meeting those challenges. You need something that's got a core, basic, simple, steady, uncomplicated, non-conceptual presence. You are here. The rest of this is noise. And just listening into that. You know. And that was very helpful for myself. I was pretty much a very heady person. Skinny, emaciated, and up in my head. And I'd been doing this kind of very up in your head meditation, where it's sort of high focus, scrutiny, attention, but disembodied, you know. So they're just kind of coming back to that. And I think it's really important, whether you do physical, what do you do, that the body, as the Buddha emphasized it, you don't touch the deathless without mindfulness of body. Mindfulness, the deathless is lost in those who do not have mindfulness of the body. You know, it's pretty strict, unambiguous statement. Yeah. Because you need the body to act as a leverage against the careening of the unawakened citta and the confused mind, the confused thinking mind. You need something to just hold it back and bring you into the present, and continually, as you cultivate it, be able to discharge and breathe out the stress and the nervous tension and breathe in the refreshment. Yeah. So then you see that as an enormous counterbalance to what samsara brings. Yeah. And without that, then people just crack up. Mm-hmm. Or distract. Or go fanatical. Or definitely lose the middle way. Without that grounding. Citta needs that foundation. Yeah. And it's possible then for the stresses and the strains to, every time you meet them and meet the challenge, are able to come out of the grip and the fluster and the reactivity, the energies move back into the center. It's like all the energy of struggle and samsara begins to transmute into strong presence. And this isn't something you can do as a decision. It's what happens when your system meets this craving, passion, agitation, moaning and complaining meets it and doesn't follow it. The energy of all that struggling stuff turns and it strengthens your core. There's a transmutation process that occurs. And that, which you're going to get a sense of that, and what Lumpur's teaching was so often to be you actually opening to the craziness. Not just finding some kind of quiet corner where you could get it all tidied up and not be bothered, but actually opening to the craziness of your own mind, of the world in general. And in accordance with your capacity, of course, to hold presence. Yeah, so it's a moderated process. You're not saying if you don't have that fundamental presence of mindfulness of the body, then you know it's kind of dangerous to open up too much. You just get overwhelmed. But the point is to gradually build up that strength to meet that, so that then the process samsara transmutes into the deathless, into that. Process. How else is it going to happen? This whole thing is not self. Who else is going to do it? What else is going to do it? Except some process that's not self. And that fundamental presence. And, you know, I could feel very quickly, hey, this is a person. You just want to sit at his feet. And that's not just me. I think many people get that same feeling. This is someone you just want to sit at his feet. And you recognize the best thing I can do is just stop thinking of reading and sit at this man's feet for 10 years and let my mind just kind of cook away until it's had enough. And it would hold it. He will, you know, that bond and his presence, if you just are able to tune into it, that holds it. And I think we find this more and more. You know, one of the good-natured mistakes is to try to find an answer to a problem or to find a solution or a device. No, you don't. In dhammic practice, you find presence to hold it and open to it, and then the transmutation can occur. And every time that occurs, your presence gets stronger. You're able to take a bit more on. Without it, you get shredded. You know, and you'd find that with Lumpur, and he'd just come into the room, he'd immediately sit down. You know, not by saying anything or doing it or demanding anything, just that it would speak for itself. He didn't really. Right. The other, obviously I could say a lot, but the other feature that I really got pretty quickly and ongoing was sila. Or ethical sensitivity, and revising and revisiting that. And with Lumpur Samedo actually as a vinaya exemplar. I mean, people often talk about his Dhamma, his meditation teachings, but what I noticed was the living example and the way he would talk about vinaya. It's actually a very profound teaching and teacher, because it was not actually the books. And I don't want to decry the books, but I can read a book. I'm not stupid, I can read a book. I can get the idea of the do's and don'ts. But to see the modulation and the moderation and the livingness of it all, and the refinement of it, and the span of it, and say, oh yeah, that's part of it too. You know? So vinaya discipline, training. You know, when we think of, certainly most of us think of morality, we think rules or laws. And that's, yeah. But, yeah, but the laws are something you kind of have to conform to. And rules are something you just kind of do the same thing. You know, all top down rules and laws, and they're abstract, and they're principles. They're abstract principles you have to conform to. Well, the symbol of sila in Buddhism is a flower. It's not a law book. It's not a set of scales. It's a flower. Something that actually has got a natural opening quality to it. And it's fragrant. They say the virtue of a wise person is like the fragrance of jasmine. It's not righteous. It's sweet. And it says it pervades everything. You can detect it. The absence of hatred, the absence of grasping, the absence of manipulation. It's got a lovely flavour to it. And to me that was very helpful. So see, this is something he'd obviously, you know, trained in a lot. And, you know, Wat Pa Pong, one of the features of renunciation, patience, endurance, enormous teaching, which he exemplified vastly, and something called vinaya. You know, and you want to open the book, and it's not quite like that. You know, there's a whole set, and based upon certain principles of what restraining, so we get one of the fundamental overriding principles of sila, ethical sensitivity or relational sensitivity, is recognizing karma, whatever you do, say, think, whatever your mind inclines towards has an effect. Whatever your mind inclines towards. Not just what you say or do, even what even you kind of give your attention to. That's going to have an effect. That's going to set your citta in somewhere or another. Yeah. So if you're inclining and you're measuring things in terms of worldly values, then your mind, your citta acquires worldly values. You know. And if you associate with people who are worldly, then that your citta acquires those habits. You know. So the sense of stewarding the citta in a relational field of what everything is affecting me, everything is, and I'm affecting everything else. You know? So one of the principles is that sense of restraint, samvara. Samvara really means something like that, just a centering, always. Things that tend to run out, or you spin out into momentum, yeah. You reach out with an impulse, or you flare up into some excitement, yeah, or big project, or you go off into a rant about something or the other. Just wait a minute, just catch the energy and draw it back. Restraining doesn't mean compressing. Or even censoring, but actually keep it within your own field and just begin to contemplate the energies and draw it back with presence, you know, bodily presence and steadying the heart. Yeah. Restraining. You know, and because Lumbo Samhita is a big person, and it got quite a lot of powerful energy, and quite passionate, a lot of vigor, passion. You know, so he could get steamed up. You know, sometimes when he got riled, it was certainly a hair, whatever hair you had on your head was raised. You had any. He didn't. But then just kind of restraining and which is his main thing, just restraining according to the Vinaya. So, you know, particularly with these, you know, we find the English Sangha Trust meeting in the early days, there were lots of squabbling and opinions and views, and you just have to, you know, finish, get exasperated and just kind of hold it back. Hold it on. And then he said at the end of the day, you just sit there looking at a kusina on the wall, which is kind of big disc, and you just sit there looking at that and letting all the angst and the passions and the irritation just, you know, drain, but thankful to have restrained the impulse to get, you know, to add more opinions and views or so on. Yeah. And restraint. So it's not just restraining the sense faculties of taste and touch and sight, it's mostly restraining the indriya, the energies that want to rush out into, you know, blaming or creating something, just kind of holding it back. And that also gives strength. If you don't censor it and blame it and hate it and get complicated about it, but just feel those energies and you hold them, the energies will, over time, will begin to turn around and build up this fundamental strength. So a lot of it's about what we don't do, and he was always very good at contentment and modesty, as an exemplar of that. So we all in those days, early days at Chidhurst House, we used to jump, you know, be crammed up in rooms, and he never ever expressed any degree of dissent or discontent with that. When he came to Amrawadi, he chose the worst room. There were large rooms on the south corridor. This, what was now here, the temple, was an old assembly hall, which had the hall, and there was a platform where I guess the teachers used to sit. And behind the platform, there was a couple of entrances, lobbies, which were like, I don't know, a lobby. In other words, like, 7 foot wide and 8 foot long or something like that. And they had one window in it, because it basically just people walk through it. People hang their coats or whatever and then walk into the hall. So it was just a passing through a lobby. So it was just one little slot window. And these places were unheated. And he said he'd want to live there. So he'd live there. There were bigger, much bigger rooms on the south corridor. And he lived in this little damp, dark room, which is exactly the opposite to what he likes. He likes sun, warmth, dry, spacious. So he chose narrow, cramped, damp, dark. I never heard a single murmur or even a comment on it. And I go round every day. Most everyone lived here because I love those feet. You know, you sit at the master's feet, you massage the master's feet. Particularly had a problem with his foot. Just something, they just get a very simple, non-complicated, non-heady relationship. I massage his feet. He is my master. Therefore, I serve. And there's that lovely feeling you could do something that simple and uncomplicated. I'll go there every day And he'd be sitting, he had this little desk, a place we could lie down. I think they'd kind of, the monks had tidied up the place as best as possible, put a light in it. And he'd say, I sit here looking at this little window. And he had a cartoon, a picture, which was like a simple photograph, illustration of an old guy holding a cup of coffee looking out the window. He said, that's what I do. I just sit here, cup of coffee, looking at the rain. Just be an old man with a cup of coffee looking at the rain. What's that? What's so good about that? Ajahn Sumedho, Dhamma master, head of the Sangha in the West, leading Western disciple Lumpo Cha, Abbot of Aranwadi. No. Old guy sitting in the damp room looking out the window at the rain. just this sort of sense of just discharging the whole kind of baba rat flow, thing that you can get over these positions of responsibility and carrying a whole lot and what people are doing and finances and community struggles and spiritual conflicts. And I'm content to be an old man sitting at the window looking at the rain. Enough. And you're just kind of looking at it and feeling it's something you just went, something I can actually feel myself just go, vroom, descend, Why is my life so complicated? Because I don't get that simple contentment. So that's a teaching in terms of Vinaya. It doesn't say, 57th rule, you should sit looking out the window of the rain. But when you look at the Patimokkha rules are there to support something bigger called the Vinaya, said the Buddha. So the rules are just kind of like fences to deal with contemporary circumstances. Underlying quality is restraint, contentment, simplicity, non-demanding, fundamental qualities. Making oneself easy to look after. I remember one time when we were at the early days at Chithurst, where there was no bathing facility, but they rigged up one shower, and the men would use it one night and the women would use it another night. There was one shower in an outhouse. You get a chance, you get your 10 minutes splashed down. Never heard anybody complain about that. And I think one of the early times a group got invited out for a dana. So it said, English people are offering dana, we should go to receive the alms food. They didn't know. So he went with about four or five others. And they went and they came back and it looked quite quiet. And we received dana. We received the offerings. End of that. Later I found out some other monk, actually they only gave us a couple of buns and a cup of tea. They didn't understand what the meal was. So he never said anything, just we received the offerings of the laity. Yeah, okay. that's what you do. He went to Mount Kailash and he got turned away at the border, ended up rather than having this fantastic pilgrimage around Mount Kailash, they sent him back, so he found this place in Nepal. And all they had for him to eat was cornflakes. So he used to have hot water and cornflakes while he was staying in his little monastery in Nepal. So Mount Kailash, Tibetan pilgrimage, holy sites, Buddhist pilgrimage turns it to be just spending a couple of weeks in a broken down monastery in Nepal eating lukewarm cornflakes. That's a spiritual pilgrimage, all right. Would you like to do that? But that's the training, just be grateful. So it's giving you that. I'm grateful you're giving that. And he was very, very strong on that. Very strong on that. And I really found myself really, really gladdened and inspired. And it's an ongoing story, isn't it? Because clearly now we don't just have warm cornflakes. You know, and then the need to keep that awareness of, yeah, sometimes there's a lot of donations, a lot of funds, a lot of stuff coming in, a lot of stuff that we keep aware, got to keep, now you've got to actually work at it. And to maintain that and keep the sense of perspective, and these are, you know, just receiving the offerings of the laity, it's good enough. Restraint. And even restraining the mind from fantasizing and thinking what should or could or what one deserves or what other people get or what other monasteries are about is no. They never complained about other monasteries either. They were criticized. Restraint. Moderation, contentment. And that means it makes it very easy. You know, the overall sense of sila and morality as an underlying quality is it like the flower, it opens so that more, it makes more and more ease and harmony in the world. Now you compare that with people who get morality as a aim for purity on a discriminated level, you get endless splits and factions and schisms with people. This group shuns that group because they have buttons on their skirts or something, you know. Or women wear lipstick or they don't, you know, this kind of thing where you get religious spats over minutiae of details on observance. And clearly, you know, that doesn't produce harm. It produces exactly the opposite. And yet people can say we're being really conscious of moral standards. Yeah? Yeah? You know? And Ajahn Sumedho's, you know, you couldn't say this is a person who seems super strict or kind of an expert on details, but he got a feeling, a gut feeling, and for the honour of the life, of the holy life. Once you get that, you don't have the doubt about the details, because the details really are that which, one of his favourite phrases, in accordance with time and place. And sometimes he'd go through these books, we'd have a video readings, and he would read the commentaries, and he'd say, you can reflect on this, practice in accordance with time and place. So you kind of like, does that mean yes, no, maybe, no. Practice in accordance with time and place, according to your own understanding. Right. And then you learn. Of course, you make mistakes. And that's normal. You make mistakes. You lose it. You lose restraint. You get indulgent. And then you observe the results of that. Learn from that, and then you're always able to vinaya, you always start again. And that's the way you learn. So the sense of kind of ultimate standard of strictness that you've got to maintain all the time was not something he ever mentioned. So always the ultimate standard is conscious awareness, notice cause and effect, take responsibility for your own welfare and the welfare of others. And that produces harmony. There's room for everyone. The other aspect of sila, vinaya and so forth is actually something, it's not about so much we look at things like we don't do, but it was also a great example of what you do do. You know, so often people think the vinaya is all the stuff you can't do. You know, we enter a life where the main theme is to not do anything, or to a life of refraining from. I'm here to refrain from. And refraining from outflowing energies and outflowing taints and destructive tendencies, absolutely. But then the other aspect is what you deliberately energize. And that makes up a huge amount of vinaya training. It means you make the effort to. What do you make the effort to do? You make the effort to honor elders. Asevanacha balanam panditananacha sevana. Avoid those of foolish ways associated with the wise. You make an effort to turn up and honor elders, just to be in their presence and just present yourself, see what you can pick up. You make the effort, a duty to be done. And he would go to Thailand every year to not just receive some kind of instruction, but just to honor and be available and whatever. Make good connections. And the Thai elders. And that created a sense of people could respect that. And along that channel of respect, this is a person who bows to people, this is a person who honors others, he's a worthy person. Someone who doesn't bow is not worth bowing to. Someone who doesn't manifest the quality of honoring respect is obviously defective. This is a worthy person because they do honoring. Yeah. And so I myself try to, as much as I can, I travel quite a bit and I make a point of visiting, although I tend to be often now the more senior, but at least when the first time I come into the monastery, the first thing I do is go at least to the Buddha Rupa. If there's nobody senior to me, there's the Buddha. And with the Sangha, whatever the Sangha are, the abbots are, first of all, pay my respects to the Buddha. This is the Sangha, this is the Triple Gem, this is their property, we're here as custodians of it for the welfare of the Sangha. So let's deal with the main principle. And then do the human elements. And just by showing up, saying, I'm interested, I'm available, I'm interested to learn, I hope to help out. That's a duty we should never neglect. If you do it like that, then it's going to be this flow of respect, gratitude and friendship. And personally, you're showing you're someone who's got some true understanding of principle. The more, you can sort of recognize also the sense in which we spend a lot of attention to looking after our requisites, properly care for, because they've been given. And they've been given. Everything we have has been given. Our clothes, the cloth has been given, the socks have been given. Toothpaste been given, buildings been given. There's our connection to the people who support us. Every time we use those things wisely, we respect the donor. Every time we don't think use these wisely, we disrespect the donor. People are offering things, then that quality of their faith, their generosity, has to be respected. And you can't meet them, you respect their offerings. Because otherwise it's not vinaya. It's not in accordance, it's not harmonious, it's not furthering. And you start saying, this is, don't want this, well, that, storing it up. So we look after these things, not because we're obsessed with possessions, but because they are they're representations of people's Dhamma practice. Faith. their efforts, their energy. They're representing that. You want to encourage this in the world. Sharing. You know, share the contents of whatever you've given to fellow summoners. So, of course, you know, Dhammawati, as many of these monasteries, it's the senior people who receive all the, you know, that's the focus point. It's often their example that encourages people's faith. And then people's faith express their faith by offering support. And the senior person then distributes it. Everybody, you know, everybody in the monastery. And there's a particular recitation we do when there's a big offering. All these offerings, you know, a portion goes to the elder, the rest of it's shared out with everybody, you know, who lives in the monastery according to the precepts. So that sharing. And of course, this place has been, you know, I won't say funded by Ajahn Sumedho, but there would not be Amrawadi in any level without that colossal example that inspired and attracted the generosity of many people throughout the world. And, you know, and that's something that one doesn't seek alms, but, you know, you know, in a way, it makes as a senior person, you're even more careful to never hint or suggest, so that it's always a very pure, and you're even more careful to not hold it yourself, because the temptations of religion have always been money and power have caused it to break down. So whenever that comes, you want to spread it. Spread it, spread it. Yeah. And so from his dana, parami, his chaga, his giving up, immense, we all benefited in many ways. Yeah. These are things that you know, you learn to both do and to how to moderate, giving up, sharing, honouring. And these are things he exemplified and continues to exemplify. You can also look in terms of the way that this cultivation is about both yourself individually, because you're going to get the results of feeling clean and clear, and that your mind isn't festering and grasping and manipulating and concerned with what you're getting and what you're not getting and who's getting a better deal. That stuff is, you've met it, you've understood it, you've listened to it, and you've been able to clear it out. You know, there's a personal sangha benefits, because if we are cultivating that each individually, then a group of people who are both restraining themselves, giving and sharing and honouring each other, can only produce a tremendous strength and harmony. Yeah. And the other sense, so we're sensitive to that. And every one of us in some ways models, whether we like it or not, whether you want to or not, you model. And when you also bear that in mind, every time you walk down the street, you model Buddhist nun, Buddhist monk. Whether you want to or not, you do. And are sensitive to that. You know, cultural, sensitive to the culture that we're in. When I first came back from Thailand and, you know, went Bindabani, said, you've got to wear sandals because people in this country feel that walking barefoot is for, you know, ignoble, or for people who are derelict. Okay, wear sandals. You know, because of the culture. One of the reasons why we have these jacket things is not just because of cold, because he felt people in this country, they associate religious people more covered up. You know, you don't want to be sort of flesh in the flesh. It doesn't seem right, this culture. So we, that also we took on. So that sense of, you know, how you're affecting, and how you're affecting other religions. Like we had We used to have every I think once a month or so, we have an interfaith gathering here. There was a nun who used to live down the road in Great Gaddesden. Miss Sister Mary. Sister Mary, was it?
Sister Mary.
And, you know, she was an elderly nun living on her own. So she'd come up. We'd try and invite her to come up, look after a bit. And we'd have, a Friday night or something, sharing circle where anybody could say their bit, you know, about their insights or their practice or religion. And she'd be there. She'd feel actually in something. Yeah. And that resulted in that kind of attitude, resulted in a huge interfaith symposium we had here where we had all the kind of Christian monks and nuns, and there were various Hindu and Jewish and, I don't know, a whole range of religions all participating in this called Faith in Awakening. And it was great because eventually all the dogmas disappeared and people were talking about the struggle of having to deal with other people and live in a monastery. or have in the kitchen. And, you know, suddenly the ideas of Jesus and the Holy Spirit all just kind of disappear. And you go down to the nitty-gritty of what it's like to be to make any kind of moral stand and any renunciation principle, in any sense of going against the tide of samsara and the human conflicts and struggles. So it's tremendously warm and friendly. And that, again, you know, that example, Ajahn Sumedho, people come, welcome everywhere, every door opens, because he doesn't start claiming he's higher or better, and we've got the right way. And that was, so you don't need to know who's got the right way, just make sure you've got your own balance. That's what counts. Yeah. So then the sila, we see it not just as something that restrains us, but something that urges us to, you know, bring forth harmonizing and beautiful and inspiring qualities into the world. Yeah. And these are what I sense are occurring here, something you're already doing and occurring here. So I'd like to offer my appreciation, gratitude for everyone participating and following those big feet while they're still around. Follow those where those big feet go, and this is the way we honor our teacher.
Anuyang dhammagata sadhukarang dadamase sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, ah.